Views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israeli troops seize control of Gaza's vital Rafah border crossing and what the White House described as a limited operation. Fears have been mounting of a full-scale invasion of the city, and ceasefire talks with Hamas remain on a knife's edge. The UN warned of a potential collapse of the flow of aid to Palestinians from the closure of Rafah and the other main crossing into Gaza at a time when officials say the northern part of the enclave is experiencing full-blown famine. The Israeli foray overnight into Tuesday came after hours of whiplash in the Israel-Hamas war. The militant group said Monday it accepted a ceasefire proposal that Israel insisted did not meet its core demands. The U.S. paused the shipment of bombs to Israel last week over concerns that Israel was approaching a decision on launching a full-scale assault on the southern city of Gaza, or I should say of Rafah, against the wishes of the U.S. That's according to a senior administration official who spoke on condition of anonymity. Shipment was supposed to consist of 1,800 2,000-pound bombs and 1,700 500-pound bombs, according to the official, with the focus of U.S. concern being the larger explosives and how they could be used in a dense urban setting. More than a million civilians are sheltering in Rafah after evacuating other parts of Gaza amid Israel's war on Hamas, which came after the militant group's deadly attack on Israel on October 7th. Millions of Indians across 93 constituencies are voting as Prime Minister Narendra Modi has mounted an increasingly shrill election campaign, ramping up polarizing rhetoric against Muslims. Modi voted Tuesday and has called the minority community infiltrators and accused his rivals of scheming to seize the wealth of non-Muslims. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin began his fifth term in a glittering Kremlin ceremony after destroying his political opposition, launching a devastating war in Ukraine, and consolidating power. Already in office for nearly a quarter century and the longest-serving Kremlin leader since Joseph Stalin, Putin's new term does not expire until 2030, when he is constitutionally eligible to run for yet another 6 years. He has transformed Russia from a country emerging from an economic collapse to a pariah state that threatens global security. Question now is what the 71-year-old Putin will do both at home and abroad over the course of another 6 years. In a world increasingly accustomed to wild weather swings, the last few days and weeks have seemingly taken those environmental extremes to a new level. Some climate scientists say that they are hard-pressed to remember when so much of the world has had its weather on overdrive at the same time. Scientists expect record weather disasters this year, connecting it to climate change, hot oceans, and El Nino. Dozens are dead in Brazil after flooding. Houston is still drying out in the U.S. from nearly 2 feet of rain, and triple-digit heat has hit from Asia to Africa, and records keep falling. TikTok and its Chinese parent company ByteDance are suing the U.S. government over a law that would ban the popular video sharing app unless it's sold to an approved buyer. The lawsuit filed Tuesday might set up what could be a protracted legal fight over its future in the United States. Companies argue that the new law vaguely paints ByteDance's ownership of TikTok as a national security threat in order to circumvent the First Amendment. Despite no evidence that the company poses a threat, it also says the law is so obviously unconstitutional that its sponsors are instead portraying it as a way to regulate TikTok's ownership. Adult star Stormy Daniels testified at Donald Trump's New York hush money trial about a sexual encounter she says they had in 2006 that resulted in her being paid off to keep silent during the presidential election a decade later. Daniels' testimony included a detailed and at times graphic accounting of an encounter Trump has denied. Daniels' testimony is central to the case because in the final weeks of Trump's 2016 Republican presidential campaign, his lawyer Michael Cohen paid her $130,000 to keep quiet. You'll find more at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi anti-corruption advocates are worried over a dropping corruption case against the Vice President Chiloma.
Continuing a high-profile case, forgiving people whom the court has justified that they were guilty of offense, I think that does not send a good message in the fight against corruption in Malawi.
Mozambique's ruling party nominates its presidential candidate. Kenya and Somalia this week signed collaboration agreements. Zimbabwe appealed to its diaspora population to invest in the country. The saga of former South African President Jacob Zuma's candidacy in the May 29 election takes a new twist.
As far as the MK party is concerned, Mr. Khumalo, who now says he has suspended Mr. Zuma, Mr. Khumalo has been expelled. But what people are saying is that he has been seen in the company of members of the ANC.
And Israel says Hamas has changed the terms of a ceasefire deal. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Anti-corruption campaigners in Malawi say the dismissal of a corruption case involving Malawi's Vice President Saulos Chilima on Monday undermines the country's efforts to curb fraud and mismanagement. Government officials said the move is constitutional, but critics view it as a clear example of selective justice favoring the elite. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's Vice President Saulos Chilima was arrested in November of 2022 after being named among 84 individuals suspected to have received bribes from a UK-based businessman, Zuneth Satam. Malawi's Anti-Corruption Bureau accused Chilima of receiving kickbacks from Satam in exchange for government contracts. However, early this month, Director of Public Prosecutions, Masaoko Chankakara, filed a notice to the High Court to drop the case in which Chilima had not taken a plea after 18 months. An order from High Court Judge Redson Kapindu issued Monday says all the charges Chilima was answering to in connection to the case have been dropped. Moses Nkandawire is the chairperson for the National Alliance Against Corruption. He told VOA that the Malawi government should have let the case proceed in court if it wants to be taken seriously in its effort to curb corruption.
If somebody has offended, violated, abused a particular law, it's extremely important that that person has to be brought before the courts of law. Because otherwise, we are just paying lip service to the fight against corruption.
Kandawire says it's unfortunate that Malawi's fight against corruption continues to favor high-profile individuals despite commitments by President Lazarus Chakwera to fight corruption without fear or favor. In May of last year, the DPP dropped a corruption case against former President Bagiri Muluzi, who was accused of diverting $11 million donation to his personal bank account while in office between 1994 and 2004. This came a month after President Chakwera pardoned the former Minister of Homeland Security, Uladi Musa, as an act of mercy during Easter. Musa was jailed in 2020 for corruption and placed on a U.S. travel ban. In July of last year, Chakwera also pardoned the country's former Minister of Information, Henry Musa, on poor health grounds. He was serving a 9-year jail term after being convicted of conspiracy to steal government property. George Piri is a former lecturer of political science at the University of Livingstonia. He says dropping a case against Chilima is detrimental to the fight against corruption.
Discontinuing a high-profile case, forgiving people whom the court has justified that they were guilty of offense, I think that does not send a good message in the fight against corruption in Malawi.
Malawian government authorities say dropping court cases is constitutional because the country's laws give the Director of Public Prosecutions the power to discontinue any case. Reacting to the development, members of the United Transformation Movement Party of Chilima on Tuesday took to the streets of the capital, Lilongwe, to celebrate the discontinuation of the case. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Mozambique's ruling Frelimo Party has picked a 47-year-old governor of a southern province to be its candidate for the next presidential election in October this year. Charles Maguire reports from Maputo.
Daniel Francisco Chapo was selected by Frelimo Central Committee late on Sunday after heated internal debates that lasted for 3 days. The selection of Chapo ended speculation that President Philippe Nyusi planned to cling to power after the end of his term through an amendment to the constitution. After his potential successor was endorsed, Nyusi appealed to party members to support their candidate and carry him to victory during the October 9 elections this year.
Termino a novela de especulações.
He said the soap opera of speculations, including the speculation about the third term, has ended. They speculated out of fear, he said. Frelimo respects the laws and there was no reason to speculate because it is in the law. Nyusi said let's all carry him as he is the face of our party in the elections on December 9th. Since Mozambique's independence in 1975, all heads of state have been nominated by Frelimo. The party has won all elections since multi-party democracy was introduced 30 years ago at the end of a crippling 16-year civil war, which left 1 million people dead and 5 million others internally displaced. Chapo has been governor of Inyambane province since 2016. He holds a master's degree in development management from a university in Mozambique. Prior to entering politics, he taught constitutional law and political science at the Universidad Católica in the port city of Beira and worked as an announcer at a private radio station in the same city. After being confirmed as Frelimo candidate, he promised to work for the development of the country's economic development. He said he must first thank the members of the Central Committee who represented more than 6 million Frelimo members in the country for the trust they have placed in me. He said that we will work on the basis of Frelimo's work program for victory on October 9th. If elected, Chapo will become Mozambique's fourth democratically elected head of state. At 47, Daniel Chapo is viewed by analysts as the leader who may be able to restore security in the troubled oil and gas-rich province of Cabo Delgado, where Islamic State-linked insurgents have been terrorizing civilians and destroying public infrastructure since 2017, forcing the interruption of multi-billion dollar projects. His predecessor, Philippe Nyusi, has failed to halt insurgency despite support by troops from other countries of the Southern African Development Community and soldiers from Rwanda. Economic analyst and university lecturer Alcide Obashita has high hopes for Chapo.
Is any individual or a person who has not been accused of corruption schemes, so I believe that these change of leadership will open a new page in the history of Mozambique, given that he's a young man who was born after the independence period of the country. So I believe that the economy of Mozambique will witness a great performance in the coming years.
Mozambique will hold its 7th presidential and legislative elections on October 9. The deadline for presenting a list of candidates for president to the Constitutional Council is June 10th. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
In South Africa, the saga of former President Jacob Zuma's candidacy in the May 29 election has taken a new twist. First, the Mail and Guardian reports that Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK Party founder Jabulani Khumalo, had asked the Independent Electoral Commission, the IEC, to remove Zuma's name from the party's parliamentary list because Zuma had been suspended. The IEC has said that Zuma's face will be on the ballot because the MK party had informed the IEC that the party has changed its leadership structure. Zuma is seen as a threat to the ruling African National Congress, the ANC. Professor Sipho Sipho is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. I asked him for clarity on this development.
It's not the MK party that has suspended Jacob Zuma. It's the man who registered the MK party, who was its president until last week. The man himself was part of the meeting where he also accepted that the new president of the MK party will no longer be him. Subsequent to that, it came to the fore that some members of the MK party were not pleased with the founder member, Mr. Khumalo. And some even suggested that he is in the pocket of the ANC. Mr. Khumalo was then suspended and expelled by the MK party. This morning, we wake up to the notion that he has decided to suspend President Zuma, who is now in terms of the IEC, which was notified that Mr. Zuma will be now the new face and the new president of the MK party. So as far as the MK party is concerned, Mr. Khumalo, who now says he has suspended Mr. Zuma, Mr. Khumalo has been expelled. But what people are saying is that he has been seen in the company of members of the ANC who are senior. And the suggestion is that he has been bought.
Professor, the request to suspend Jacob Zuma goes to the IEC. Whether the IEC is going to accept that. So what is the response from the IEC?
The IEC has already responded. It has rejected the submission by Mr. Khumalo, pointing out very clearly that they had received a letter notifying IEC that Mr. Zuma will now be the president. And that was before Mr. Khumalo was suspended. And Mr. Khumalo has also held a press conference where he had declared himself no longer the president of MK party. So what people see this, they see this as some of the shenanigans of the ANC to try to create a disruption within the MK party. But that does not mean that the MK party may not have its own problems. The mere fact that the founder of the MK party was expelled simply shows that there are issues that they must iron out.
Professor Sipo Sipe is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 8th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Zimbabwe's government is now appealing to its diaspora population to invest in the Southern African nation to revive its moribund economy. But Zimbabweans who left the country due to political or economic reasons are not allowed to vote, and many are now refusing to respond to an appeal from the government to invest in the country to improve the nation's economy.
The government says the Zimbabwe Investment Summit held Thursday to Saturday in South Africa was meant to present the Southern African nation positively to the world. Speaking at the conference, Finance Minister Muthuli Ncube said Zimbabwe's economy was one of the fastest growing in the region and investors should get on board.
Zimbabwe's economic recovery post-COVID is strong. We've seen it roll from strength to strength after a dip in 2019 and 2020. In 2021, the economy has been on a positive trajectory with real GDP growth at 8.5% in terms of growth in 2021, that is 6.5% in 2022, and a growth rate of 5.5% in 2023. And the growth rate is projected at 3.5% this year, slower growth than the previous 3 years due to the climate change shocks.
At the conference, Ncube also promoted various tax rebates and incentives for investors who import equipment such as buses for a tourism company. However, Treasurer Basopo, an economist who left Zimbabwe 3 years ago for Norway, says before investors can get interested, inflation has to be tamed and the country must establish confidence in the new currency, the ZiG. The currency is backed by Zimbabwe's gold reserves, a method of establishing value that most countries abandoned many years ago. Basopo is skeptical.
The introduction of ZiG defeats, by all definitions and by all intents and purposes, the characteristics or the traditional characteristics of what is money, which is basically the ability to store value, durability, scarcity, and acceptability.
Inflation, meanwhile, is running at an average of 55%, lower than the hyperinflation which plunged Zimbabwe in the past, but still high enough to make cost of living difficult for most ordinary Zimbabweans. At the investment conference, Ngwe voiced support for the ZiG, saying the country needs a domestic currency.
It's a currency that is backed by reserves, a gold, and other precious minerals, as well as hard currency. The exchange reserve fluctuates. We from time to time share with the public as how much reserves we have. Yes, we will. There will be an audit of the reserves, and we will share that information periodically with the public to make sure that we can build the necessary comfort in the new currency.
Basopo said, besides lower inflation and a stable currency, investors in the diaspora also want the right to vote in Zimbabwe's elections.
This is a government which has lost all of its goodwill, and it has lost all of its international credibility to access credit facilities. And they now want to harvest that money from the citizens for you to demonstrate patriotism, which is okay. But what we just need to do right now is for the diaspora to have the political rights enshrined within the national constitution of the land, for us to enjoy the rights to voting. You cannot invest in a country in which you can't have a say.
VOA made repeated efforts to talk to government officials about the conference, but did not get a response. Government officials say several hundred people attended the three-day event, but they have not announced any new investments from the conference. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare.
Kenya and Somalia this week signed an agreement on collaboration in the areas of political consultations, education, and events. The agreement follows the third session of the Joint Commission of Cooperation, the JCC, between the two countries held in Nairobi last week. Macharia Munene is a professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi, Kenya. He tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the agreement is a small but positive step.
Well, these are small steps forward. And there is a concerted effort to deal with the long-standing hostility between the two countries. So it's a positive step forward, but people should not put too much hope that everything will be over. But these are good steps.
There are some friction between the two countries, but then Somalia joined the East African community. Wouldn't some of these have been worked out in the East African community?
Well, the community is a big dream, but the fact that more and more countries are joining does not mean that the frictions disappear. After all, the Congo joined, and we still have a problem. And we still have those, even the original members of the community, occasionally disagree there in a very serious way. So, but it's a big hope that by Somalia joining the East African community, and there's even dreams that maybe Ethiopia might even join it one day. Then some border issues will go down the ladder. At present, we have border issues, immigration challenges, expectations. So the East African community might try to smoothen rough feathers here and there. Becomes a good vehicle for dealing with those things. But it will not eliminate the challenge that is inherent in the relationship between the two. We still have what used to be the dream of the Somali uniting all regions, the Somali people, wherever they are, under one umbrella. That seems to have been put aside. And so you have now the new strategy, it appears, of penetrating different areas and not creating frictions. So what we have signing up here and there is a way of at least extending the Somali influence without being confrontational.
Macharia Munene is a professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi, Kenya. He spoke with viewers Douglas Umpuga. Israel says there are still differences with Hamas over details of a proposed ceasefire, but says it is sending a delegation to Cairo for further talks on the deal. Hamas announced on Monday that it had accepted the ceasefire deal, and reports say the U.S. has given guarantees that the fighting will not be renewed. Linda Christine reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israel is sending a delegation back to Cairo for more talks on the details of a ceasefire. The Israeli move came a day after Hamas made a surprise announcement that it accepted an Egyptian ceasefire proposal that Israel had previously accepted. But on Tuesday, Israeli officials said that the terms Hamas accepted are not the same as those in the original Egyptian proposal, and that the changes that Hamas is demanding make it impossible for Israel to agree. Israeli officials said the first stage of the deal envisions the release of 33 humanitarian hostages, meaning women, the elderly, and the sick, in exchange for a six-week ceasefire and the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. But now Hamas says that some of those 33 who would be freed have died. There are also questions on the timing of the release and how many Palestinian prisoners will be freed for each hostage. Brigadier General Yisrael Ziv, a former commander of the Gaza district, says that Israel's first priority must be to bring the hostages home.
The first priority is to maximize the option for the deal. We understand that the time is running out for the life of the hostages, and the maximum pressure is about that. You know how many people alive we can evacuate through such a deal.
Israel also has questions about reported guarantees that the U.S. and Egypt gave Hamas that Israel will not restart the war in Gaza and that the ceasefire will continue indefinitely. A U.S. government spokesman would not comment on the reports. Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer says that even though the Hamas proposal falls far short of what Israel wants, Israel will negotiate in good faith.
The war cabinet unanimously decided Israel will continue its operation in Rafah in order to apply military pressure on Hamas to release our hostages and achieve all the war's objectives. Despite Hamas's grandstanding, Hamas's proposal is far from Israel's core demands. Nevertheless, Israel will dispatch a ranking delegation to Egypt to maximize any chance of an agreement on terms acceptable to Israel.
On Tuesday, Israeli tanks and troops took over the Palestinian side of the crossing between Israel and Egypt. The Palestinian Authority called on the U.S. to stop Israel from invading the city of Rafah. General Ziv said the Israeli action to take over the crossing was a limited operation and not the large-scale invasion Israel has threatened.
The purpose of this operation, I would say, is mainly to leverage the negotiation been done this time, trying to get a better deal, or I would say to lower down the demands of the Hamas, asking actually from Israel to stop the war and to get into a full ceasefire.
As the war hits the seven-month mark, the Hamas-run health ministry says the death toll is close to 35,000, although that includes both fighters and civilians. More than 1,300 people in Israel have been killed, most of them in the initial October 7th attack by Hamas, and more than 130 Israelis are still being held hostage by the militant group. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And that's it for this Wednesday, May 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.